A real pleasure to have another opportunity to chat with Mark Rubinstein, author of Net Interest, a weekly newsletter on financial sector themes. Mark, you wrote an article about Irish banks this week, a fascinating look at the changing landscape there. And you even brought in the book Capital Returns, which I thought was a very interesting way to set this up.
Well, thank you, John. It is a great book. It's one of my favorite investment books. And it focuses on supply side rather than demand side dynamics in any industry, and banking is no different. When I've looked at banks before, historically, I've been taught to look at loan demand, for example, but actually, the amount of capital available in the system that sits on banks' balance sheets is a pretty good indicator of certainly the supply side, but therefore where we sit in that overall capital cycle. And Ireland presents a fantastic historical story. The story itself, I think, is quite well known. I'd be surprised if listeners weren't familiar with the Irish real estate cycle. But what's interesting is here we are 12 years on now, 2021. It's been a long time since the Irish real estate cycle has gripped headlines. And yet there are still developments that emanate from the crisis in 2008. And those are the developments that I wanted to talk about.
And so I guess the book Capital Returns, you basically focusing on supply rather than demand dynamics, and now the supply side looks very interesting. But let's first talk about that history that's also interesting here, just in terms of how big that bubble was in Irish real estate and associated lending.
Well, it got pretty big. Now, we've got to cast our minds back to the 1990s, which is when I started my career. Ireland was a small market on the periphery of Europe. Actually, it had also been home to the biggest migration, the biggest outward migration of population almost in human history. Obviously, a big source of the migration into the United States and elsewhere. Population never really recovered. It was quite small. And the economy was a kind of a typical peripheral European economy. A number of things changed. Tax incentives were introduced. Ireland joined the EU, and therefore that led to small migration inwards, coupled with those tax incentives. But then critically, in 1999, it was one of the first economies to join the single monetary union, the Eurozone. And as a result, for the first time, almost in its history, Ireland had access to cheaper funding, to funding that wasn't underwritten off of Ireland's own particular credit risk, but was on a par with European aggregate credit risk. And that had a huge difference. We saw a lot of fund flow into Ireland, coupled with the fact that the population spoke English, coupled with the fact that it was a member inevitably of the EU, coupled with these tax incentives, led the economy to do quite well, led the economy to boom. Alongside that, the real estate market also started to boom. Kind of inevitable consequence, which we've seen globally, doesn't have to be toxic, doesn't have to lead to crisis. What was different about Ireland is that that real estate market then developed a life of its own. So that real estate market, largely various reasons, but one of them being the supply of funding from the Eurozone, that market grew. And it became untethered from the economy. Actually, it drove the underlying economy. So by the time that market peaked in kind of the mid-2000s, about one in five of the Irish workforce were working in the construction industry. and the construction industry broadly had swelled to contribute almost a quarter of Irish GDP. Unlike in the UK and some other markets, the supply of housing rose to meet the demand, hence the increase in the construction industry. And actually, at the peak, the number of homes being built in Ireland was kind of half what was being built in the UK, even though the population was a 15th of the size. So construction, real estate markets broadly grew to be a very, very large share of the Irish economy come 2005.
Those are amazing statistics. And domestic banks in Ireland grew their balance sheets to 5 times GDP. Also pretty stunning. And then you talk about some of the competitive dynamics where Anglo-Irish Bank was really aggressive about market share, and then the response by Bank of Ireland as well.
Exactly. So historically, Ireland was a small market, as we've discussed. There were a number of banks. Bank of Ireland and AIB, which stands for Allied Irish Banks, had been present in the market for certainly since the 1700s, 1800s. Irish Permanent, which became Permanent TSB, was founded as a building society in the 19th century, much smaller bank. But there were these homegrown banks that did what banks do. When the real estate market took off, and even prior to that, Ireland became attractive to some foreign banks as well. So we saw, as you say, huge growth in the banking system to 5 times GDP that emerged from some homegrown banks like AIB, Allied Irish Banks, Bank of Ireland, Irish Permanent, which became known as Permanent TSB, but then also some foreign banks. So Danske Bank of Denmark saw Ireland as a source of growth. KBC of Belgium saw Ireland as a source of growth. A number of the UK banks, Bank of Scotland, from the UK, started a presence actually back in 1999 in Ireland. Ulster Bank was a homegrown Irish bank, but it was acquired by NatWest Group, and that was active as well. Long list of banks, probably 9 or 10 banks. The poster child, as you highlighted, high growth bank in Ireland, was a bank called Anglo-Irish Bank. Anglo-Irish Bank was founded as a small finance business focused pretty exclusively on real estate lending. And it had a slightly differentiated model, which was to attract property developers, not that many of them. So it had a small list of property developers that it worked with. It did big ticket lending to them. It was able to keep costs down because it didn't operate through a branch network. Actually, about its top, kind of mid-2000s, its top 20 clients made up half of its loan book. So it did business with the same few clients, property developer clients, but it was profitable. Big ticket loans, very, very profitable. That attracted the attention of the other banks. Clearly, Anglo-Irish was growing in the sector, which itself was growing very rapidly. Anglo's own loan book grew at 40% a year in the mid-2000s, and it attracted the attention of the other banks. So other banks decided that they needed to, it's kind of reminiscent, we've spoken before, John, about Citi and the notion of dancing whilst the music is still playing. And there was something of those competitive dynamics to the Irish banking market as well in the mid-2000s. So Bank of Ireland CEO allegedly said that he wanted to grow at 30% a year. Allied Irish Banks, and Michael Lewis, who's a fantastic writer. I think we've spoken about Liar's Poker before, but he wrote a book, not one of his most widely read, but he wrote a book in 2011, 2012 called Boomerang about the European, about the boom and bust that occurred in Europe, and dedicates a chapter to Ireland in that book. And he says that Allied Irish Banks, AIB, actually set up a unit called ABA, which is anybody but Anglo. And the idea there was that they were hyper-competitive and wanted to poach Anglo's largest clients, these kind of 20 property developers in Ireland who were very active and very profitable for Anglo at that time. Very, very intense competition led to a loosening of lending standards in order to every bank, all of the kind of 10, let's say 10 banks were chasing every last euro, and they were chasing it down to the lowest common denominator. It was the worst kind of loan that they were doing. And that basically is what ultimately led to the crisis, the real estate crisis in Ireland in 2008.
You also quote John Hampton as saying the most scary thing to invest in is a fast-growing financial, and certainly pre-2008 that applied very much to Irish banks. You discuss what happened after the boom and the long tail of that collapse.
That's right. So it took what was interesting, actually, and this was obviously a very nervy time globally across markets and in the financial industry. We're talking now about September 2008. So clearly Lehman has gone bust in the middle of September 2008. Within 2 weeks, it's becoming apparent that some Irish banks are not able to refinance themselves. Anglo was in the crosshairs. It wasn't Irish Permanent. It was back in the beginning of September. It was the Irish Nationwide Bank was having difficulty financing. And then Anglo, ultimately, come the end of 2008, a lot of nervousness. And this was at a time when European ministers were meeting, and Ireland actually broke with the pack. And overnight, on the 29th of September 2008, they decided that the solution to this problem of banks not being able to fund themselves was, and I should just go back 1 second and say that the issue had become untenable because in order to finance all of that growth in the early to mid 2000s, the kind of 40% a year loan growth that Anglo was seeing, the 30% that Bank of Ireland wanted, they'd exhausted all of the supply of deposits available in Ireland and were forced to go abroad and seek new funding lines outside of the classical Irish deposit funding base. And it was those lines that were drying up, and that was having a knock-on effect. And there was a real danger of a run on the banks in Ireland at the end of 2008. Seeing all of this, the Irish authorities decided to backstop Irish bank funding. And they launched a huge guarantee of all bank liabilities in Ireland. It was close to 2x GDP, the backstop. And it was, I think to this day, it can be considered the worst misdiagnosis of a problem in the financial industry in history. Because the problem wasn't liquidity, the problem was solvency. The authorities had convinced themselves that the property loans were largely money good, and that the issue of liquidity is the one that needed to be resolved rather than bank solvency. And they were being egged on actually by the bank. So Anglo-Irish's chief financial officer, even at the end of 2008, actually even in December of 2008, he was still suggesting that losses at his bank would be between 300 and 600 million euros. Actually, they were 35 billion euros. At the end of 2008, he was suggesting between 300 and 600 million euros. There were 35 billion when the dust settled. So huge kind of mischaracterization of what the problem was that permeated all the way through from the banks to the Irish authorities, led to the Irish government coming in, backstopping the entire banking system, which bankrupted it, ultimately led to bailout by the European Union, the IMF. And in any event, the Irish government ultimately had to not only stand by that liquidity backstop, but had to provide solvency support ultimately as well when the misdiagnosis became clear.
And so that then set in motion a really more than a decade-long process of winnowing of the banking landscape in Ireland to where we are today.
Exactly right. And that's what brings us up to today. So far, this has been a very interesting history lesson. There are some takeaways from it. John Hempton's point about the most scary thing to invest being a fast-growing financial is one. The whole concept of boom and bust is another. Capital cycle dynamics, fantastic case study. But to bring us up to the current point in time, what was interesting is, and perhaps inevitable, is the degree to which the banks that had been very, very quick to rush in to this market then retrenched. So, and they retrenched for a number of different reasons. Some of them went bankrupt. So Anglo-Irish Bank was nationalized in 2009. Initially, the government thought it could actually put it back out again. It could rehabilitate Anglo-Irish Bank and build a new bank around it. But by mid-2010, they saw that was too difficult and they put it into runoff. So that's one bank gone. Irish Nationwide, actually huge losses built up on its balance sheet, had to write off a quarter of its loan portfolio in 2009. That was also nationalized and also put into runoff. There was another bank called EBS, another building society called EBS, that was sold to AIB for a euro. So a little bit of consolidation that wasn't put into runoff. It was sold to AIB for a euro, so a bit of consolidation there. Bank of Scotland, remember we'd said earlier, they came in from the UK. By then, Bank of Scotland was part of Lloyds. In 2008, Lloyds and HBOS, previously it had been part of HBOS. It's what the BOS stands for in HBOS. It merged with Lloyds, and they decided just to hand in literally their banking license back to regulators and get out. And by the end of 2010, they were gone. Took a few years, but eventually Danske Bank in 2013, they decided they were going to close down their operations, personal and business banking in Ireland, and get out. So you're basically down to five banks in Ireland. Bank of Ireland, AIB, Ulster Bank, which was owned by NatWest in the UK, KBC, owned by KBC in Belgium, and Permanent TSB, which was the smaller bank, homegrown bank in Ireland. What's interesting is that, and that was the case from 2013, 2014, it was really 2014 when Danske Bank got out, up until now. Six, seven years later, though, two of those banks out of those five have decided actually they've had enough. It's a tough market, difficult to make returns. There hasn't been much loan growth as a result of the deleveraging that went on in the system. Low interest rates and heightened regulation have made it very difficult for these banks to make money. And basically, the market wasn't big enough for those five banks. Ulster Bank had a 15% market share, but wasn't able to generate a material return off that. And so Ulster Bank recently decided it was out. NatWest held a strategic review. Not their first, actually. They held one back in 2014 and decided 15% was enough to give them critical mass in that market. But recently they decided that whether things have changed, certainly management has changed at that bank, they decided that they're out. And then KBC of Belgium has announced that they're out as well. Both of them selling portfolios of loans to Bank of Ireland and AIB. And so what you're left with, as we sit in 2021, 12 years after the crisis and a number of years after the resolution of that crisis, we're left with a duopoly. Actually, it's not technically true. You've got Irish permanent TSB in there as well, but to all intents and purposes, it's a duopoly of Bank of Ireland and AIB. And this makes Ireland actually quite unique because there are not that many markets. It's a small market, sure, but there aren't that many markets with that kind of concentration in their banking systems, which brings us back to the capital returns and the idea of the capital cycle. You've seen this whole cycle, a lot of capital entering that market on the supply side, and then some retrenchment. Some of it was destroyed, some of it was consolidated, and now some of it is exiting. And you're left with this duopoly of capital around two players.
And some argue that actually your friends at Permanent TSB could be looked at by the Irish government to play a bit of a role as well here on the competitive landscape. And I think I saw some news that Permanent TSB is picking up some branches from Ulster as well, but clearly they're a distant number three.
Yeah, they're a distant number three. I suspect their presence makes it acceptable. And the Irish government owns 75% of Permanent TSB. They own 70% of AIB and 14% of Bank of Ireland. So they still have a presence. So it could be that their presence, particularly in Permanent TSB, makes it more amenable to the market, makes a duopoly maybe, or three players in any event, more acceptable than might otherwise have been the case if this was a purely commercial, purely private market with no government intervention whatsoever. Nevertheless, already in Ireland, we're seeing, so KBC had the lowest mortgage rates, they've now gone. Ireland, in any event, has higher mortgage rates than other economies in Europe. We're seeing now some of the banks begin to pass on negative interest rates to their depositors. So we're beginning to see the beginnings of, and this is all coincident with those banks exiting the market, but we're beginning to see the early signs of pricing power flow to the providers of banking services in Ireland. And there's another final point which I'd make, which is we look at what's interesting about banking. It's a highly localized market, but there's a common theme wherever you look around the world. And one common theme is low interest rates, which are a global phenomenon, which are hurting bank profitability around the world. Another common theme is heightened regulation, which is also common to all banks around the world and has stifled profitability over the past 10 years. But a third common theme is that actually industry structure matters. And a fundamental reason why profitability in banking is low in Germany and Japan is because in those markets, there are fragmented banking systems, actually also with some government involvement. And in contrast, in the Nordic countries and in Canada, where there are much more concentrated banking markets with no government involvement, in those markets, profitability tends to be a lot higher. So the extent to which Ireland is moving towards a degree of greater concentration, that looking at that framework has implications for the profitability of that industry.
And very quickly, I don't want to start a whole new subject, but where would you put England on that scale?
Yeah, so the UK is more fragmented. UK is more fragmented, but we haven't even discussed the new entrants. Although in many of these markets, certainly in the mortgage market, their share is quite low. But it is more fragmented. The not-for-profit, there's one large not-for-profit organisation in the UK, which is the Nationwide Building Society, but the share of not-for-profit would be a lot lower than in Germany. Or in Japan. So it would sit probably somewhere in the middle, closer to, it would sit somewhere in the middle.
Great. Well, we'll certainly be looking at Ireland as a prospective case study of the capital cycle theory. And so something we can actually watch in real time as opposed to just looking ex post facto. Mark, thank you so much for today's conversation.
Thanks, John.